Oh, it works.
Oh, it works.
Oh, I picked out the shorter stool. I got a stool like this at work. I used to. They took it away from me. They afraid I was going to hurt myself when I fell off it when I went to sleep. Now I have to sleep standing up. I want to give you a little background on the 12 steps. We talk about the 12 steps a whole lot. And I've, over the years, gained some knowledge of them, and I've discovered some more information here recently. These 12 steps are based on ancient principles. Not just Christian, Hindu, Buddhism, there's a long list of philosophies throughout the ages that have used these principles that are contained in the 12 steps. We call them the 12 steps of Sex Acts Anonymous. Everybody knows most everybody knows they came from AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. But AA gave us permission to adopt them and use them as our own. And they've given hundreds of other fellowships the same right. And I always want, when they did that, they're kind of tight about everything else. They won't give you permission to reprint their promises or reprint anything else in their book, only the 12 steps. But their principle is that these are principles that was given to us, and we don't own them. And I never understood that until here recently, that they are principles. Now, they wasn't always 12 steps. They were just, concepts. Back in the early 1930s, an alcoholic named Roland, I can use his last name, I guess, Hazard. He's long gone. Was having trouble drinking. And he tried many ways to stop. And his family sent him to Switzerland under the care of Dr. Carl Jung, a renowned psychologist. He stayed a year there. And they said he did fantastic work, and he really had this thing down. They thought he was going to be okay, and they sent him home. Well, he got drunk. So he ran back to Carl Jung and said, "What do I do? Something's got to, And Mr. Jung, this psychologist, who at the time you couldn't, mix psychology with religion, he said, "We've done about everything we can do. You may be one of those who are just destined to be institutionalized with alcoholism." So, but on occasion, I've heard of people having a spiritual solution. And I understand that Roland Hatters thought this was great. "Oh yeah, I go to church and, I can do that." He said, No. "I'm talking about a spiritual conversion that changes your ideas, attitudes, and emotion from ground up." He said, "Oh, okay." So he left. And he found his way into the Oxford groups. Now, this was a religious group, Christian. And they were dedicated to just helping people out. And they wanted to practice Christianity the way they thought it should have been practiced right after Christ. And it comes to find out they were studying the Franciscans, Francis of Assisi, and his teachings. And he had picked up these principles of getting honest with yourself. Clean up the past the best you can. Helping others and trusting God to help you do those things. And the Oxford group picked this up. So Roland Hazard got into Oxford group, and he did that, and he found another friend of his in there, and they were working on alcoholism. And they heard about Abby Thatcher, who was fixing to go to court. He drove his car through a lady's living room, and he'd had a lot of trouble with alcohol. He's looking at getting put in an asylum. They're going to lock him up. And Roland and his friend went to the court, went to the judge, and said, "Give him to us. We got a program that might help him. Let us try." So the judge turned him over to him. And he worked it. He started working the program. And then he heard about Bill Wilson holed up in New York, holed up in his house trying to drink himself to death. So he got dressed up and went to see Bill Wilson. And Bill thought he was coming over to have a drink with him. You know, they were old drinking buddies. He said, no, not today. He said, what's the matter, buddy? You quit drinking? Y'all know, I just don't drink today. He said, what's going on? He said, well, I got religion. Bill didn't want to hear more about that. But this image of his buddy, clean shaven in a suit, you know, all dressed up, and he's sitting there in his slippers and pajamas. He's like, well, that should be me out there going to help other people. You know, that made him kind of jealous. He saw something he wanted. So he tried to, went to a meeting of, I can't even think of the name, I just said it a while ago, Oxford Group. And he was already drunk when he got there, so he did get saved, and he, you know, singing songs and everything, and he didn't remember a thing about it the next day. He checks himself back in the hospital, and he's laying in bed the next day, going through the DTs and withdrawals. And he's scared to death, because the last time he was in that hospital, the doctor told his wife, you just leave him here, it's committing. There's nothing we can do for somebody that drinks like he does in his condition. And he begged his wife to take him home. What? Give me one more try. And he had his one more try. So he figured he's going to get locked up. This is it. End of the road for him. And laying in the bed, he said, God, if there is a God, I need you. And he says, the room lit up. Yeah. It's like he's on the top of a mountain, the clear breeze blowing through. He had a spiritual awakening. So he got out of the hospital. He went to help others, join the Oxford Group. And they formed the Alcoholics Wing of the Oxford Group. We're trying to help these alcoholics. He's having people stay in his house. He's going around and getting up to winos and, you know, everybody cut off the street trying to help them. And he couldn't get anybody sober. You know, several months. He complained to his wife. He said, I don't, this works for me, but I can't help anybody else. It's not working. She said, well, you're staying sober. Uh-huh. Helping others, practicing some principles. So after 4 years, AA's got about 100 people. They decide they need a book. They need to raise some money so they can make this thing grow. So we need to write a book, you know, and so we can sell it and make money. Bill, you're one of the co-founders of it, you know, you're the kind of person to write it. You need to write it. Bill Wilson wrote 3/4 of the book. You know, more about alcoholism. There's a solution. Family afterwards, you know. Had 3/4 written, and he still hadn't written how it works. And he said, Bill, we've got to get the book written. You got to get this done. So one afternoon, he went to his meditating room. He had a little room underneath the stairs with a cot in it where he'd meditate. Took his notepad, went sit on that cot. He wrote out these 12 steps. He broke those principles down into a little more detail and more meat to them. And then he came out and showed it to the rest of them. They said, this is it, Bill. This is what we're going to go with. So that's where those 12 steps came from. Based on principles. Get honest. Trust God. Help others. So we read the 12 steps, and that's what they're about. It's nice to say, well, that sounds great. I think I'll do it. You know, and that's what I said when I first heard of them. Yeah, I think everybody ought to live like that. Yeah. So why couldn't I do it? I had to have a flame floor at my rear end to get me into this. So that's the story of the 12 steps. Now we're going to get into my story. Hi, my name's Tom, and I'm a sex addict.
It's done.
And today that's okay. I haven't found it necessary to act out in my bottom line. I may have come close, but I haven't hit that bottom line since October 23rd, 2003. And for that, I'm grateful. It's all through this program, those 12 steps, and the fellowship of Sex Addicts Anonymous. I guess my problem started out when I was born. You know, that's I was premature, 4 pounds, you know, little tiny thing. And it seemed like they put me in the crib, when I'd go to sleep, I would quit breathing and turn blue. And if a nurse didn't have to be passing by and sleep me and pick me up and get me breathing again, I would have died. So after 3 days, my mother went down to the nursery, going to pick me up. She doctor released her. She's going to get me and go home. They said, oh, you can't have him. He's sick. He can't go nowhere. He said, no, he's fine. You know, I'm going to take him home. And call the doctor in there. The doctor said, let her have him. There's nothing we can do for him. He's going to die anyway. So I'm glad he was wrong. Yeah, I make it. You hear through my story. I like making fools out of doctors and priests and everybody else. You know, I kind of talk. I'm not really don't mean that. It's just, you know, it's just building up my own ego that, you know, that we got to take care of here. Now, mother got me home and just set me up in a bassinet, put pillows behind me so I was tilted up. You know, sitting beside the bed, and she got in bed and she'd put pillows behind her, so she was kind of sitting up so she could just open her eyes and see me and see if I was turning blue. Well, it seems like when you set me up like that, I didn't turn blue. Yeah. So, mother ingenuity, intuition, God's help, something. Yeah. I get to be a miracle today. But it didn't, you know, sometimes they didn't know that wasn't, but, you know, sometimes I get in the middle of the day, they put me down for a nap, I turn blue, somebody happened to walk by and see me and grab me up, and I just, you know, had to make it. Well, I guess that set me up for being kind of self-centered. You know, when I cried, people come running. You know, always watching me, yeah, you know, keep an eye on me. Anytime I achieved anything, wow, look what Tommy did. You know, he wasn't supposed to be able to do anything, you know. I'm going to rush forward. I usually talk about what happened to me in my childhood, some of the things, some of my excuses. My therapist said, don't call them excuses. There's reasons. You know, some things happen to you are reasons. I said, yeah, but those things happen to other people, they don't do the same thing I did. Yeah. Everybody doesn't awfulize everything like I do, doesn't get the same take from it. He said, no. But whatever you get from it is what you're supposed to get. Oh, really? So, I grew up with a kind of a paradox in my view of sex. I had one grandma, we called her grandma, she's my mother's mother, called her granny, not grandma, granny, that was granny, and my mother was working away, we lived right behind them, so I'd always stand with granny all the time. Well, I'm 5 years old, watching soap operas or something. Something came up and granny told me, well, you know, about sex, and granny said, good little boys and girls, don't know about it, talk about it, or think about it. That's what I heard. On the weekends, we'd go over to my father's mother. That was grandma. She was a hairdresser. They liked to drink. That's the reason they went over there, to have a big party. And people were laughing and slapping panties, and, you know, and I come to realize, well, you know, it's okay if you do it, you just don't tell anybody. So I guess that's what I learned about sex. Good little boys and girls know about it, but as long as you don't tell nobody, it's okay. My parents divorced when I was about 12. It's probably the most traumatic thing I can remember. Is that part of my life. Up to that point, it was the most traumatic. My family is gone, you know? Just nothing's right anymore. And through a chain of circumstances, my father being a lawyer and wanted to have things his way, somehow I ended up living with him when I'm 12 years old. He kept the house. Mother went and bought herself another house, got her a job, and she had me a bedroom. My bedroom, my clothes, everything's right there for me. My dad said, the boys, you need to come with me and your brother, stay with a man, a man would be a man. And so I went with him, because I knew it'd be more fun with him, because he drank all the time. I used to joke about it, he's drunk, In school, they said, in eighth grade, they said, write about your father. I said, how you spell drunk, but that meant I got to do anything I wanted to do. See, freedom. I'm 12 years old, I get to do anything I want to. Oh, boy. Self-centered gets to do anything you want to at 12 years old. Yeah, that's a good combination. I see success now, So, like I say, it traumatized me quite a bit. I would be walking around, we lived in the house, of course, the house, my father threw a big party a little while after I got divorced, and I had my first alcohol at that when I was 13, and I come to find out it was a house closing party. The bank was going to repossess the house the next day. We had to move. So we ended up, he moved to the YMCA. Got three rooms. Well, got two rooms, one for him, one for me and my brother. I'm living at the YMCA downtown. You got one little room with a cot. Down the hall, there's one big bathroom for everybody on the floor, all men. Yeah. But it was an adventure. I guess it fits in my story to tell you some of what happened to me. After that first drink, I went to spend the night with a friend of mine. Actually, I was supposed to live with him that summer, but the first night we ran out and he stole his parents' car if they passed out drunk. And we got some beer and we got drunk. The police called us, took a beer away and sent us home. And the next night we stole the car and went out and got drunk. Because after that first drink, I liked it. From then on, I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could. I can get hold of, when I got a hold of alcohol, I got all I could stand. So the very next, so the police called us again, took us home, took a beer away, took us home. Very next night, we got some beer, and we didn't get to drink one. The police pulled us over. And they took us home and told his parents. And she said, you got to go. You can't stay here. You're a bad influence on my son. So I went to live at the Y. And I started drinking as much as I could. I had other friends. One had a car. One of those friends showed me how that when you're broke and you ain't got no money and you want something to drink, you can go stand on this corner down there by Lynn Park and men will come by. And you get in the car with them, they'll give you $10, $15. Sexual favors, So there at 13 years old, wanting to drink, I became a street prostitute. What a big deal to me, I don't know, just don't tell nobody, it's okay. Nobody knows, I don't have to be ashamed. But thank goodness we didn't live there for about a year and a half, 2 years. We moved, and I kind of got away from that. Didn't have to drink quite as much, but I still liked to drink, and whenever my friends went out, I was pretty much I wasn't an instigator, but I was always one knew how to get money, to get beer, to get drunk, and you know, and I had a lot of friends because of that. One night when I was living at the Y, I'm walking around at night and I'm missing something, I'm just feeling pitiful because of the parents' divorce and life ain't right and I'm lonely. And I made up my mind, I said, when I get married, I'm gonna marry a kind of woman that will never do anything cause me to want to divorce her, and I'll never think, do anything to make her want to divorce me. I'm gonna make sure that my kids do not have to go through this. Made a solemn vow to myself. That was my prime objective in finding a girlfriend. I went there, and as luck would have it, I ran across this, when I was 16, ran across this 14-year-old girl that's never been dated, never been kissed, never been out on a date. Her mother just smothered her with love, And, but she was 14. She was, it's about time, Mama had to start letting things go a little bit. And I asked her out on a date with the rest of the gang. And the other mothers around the neighborhood heard that I'd asked her out. And they called her up and started telling her about me. And the next day I went over to her house and she called me in the hallway. She said, Tommy, said some of the ladies in the neighborhood have been calling me. They said, you're a bad person. You drank, you drug, you rape, and you're just a terrible person. And my immediate thought was those lying wenches, Why would they tell her I do drugs? So I ain't done drugs yet. Everything else might be true, but not the drugs. But she said, the past 2 weeks you've been around here, you've been perfect gentleman. See, my parents had raised me so I knew how to act good. I had good values, honesty, integrity. I thought I knew how to be a good person. It was just getting what I wanted required me to do strange things. But she said, I trust you. I'm going to trust you with the most precious thing in my life. And I took that as a good responsibility. At 16 years old, I quit drinking. I started acting right. I'm trying to figure out how to have sex with a good girl. As long as nobody knows about it, it's okay. Well, that was probably a good part of my good portion of my life, a good period of my life. All my friends quit high school. All ones I hung out with, that was in the band with, they all quit, got jobs, and I stayed in school. And I graduated and ready to go to college and called my dad up and said, "Hey, I graduated and got an advanced academic scholarship. What do you think I ought to do about college?" He said, "You better save some money." I ain't got none. My dad was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. He had just joined Alcoholics Anonymous. He was on his way to asylum. And he had heard about AA, and he told my stepmother, said, "Please, let me have one try with this AA thing before I go to asylum." She said, "Okay." And he tried AA, and AA saved his life. And I first heard about the 12 steps then. Didn't read them, I'm just glad he was kind of happy for him being sober, I'd been through a mess with him, especially at the Y. He'd be passed out in bed for 3 or 4 days, going through the DTs, and he'd tell me to go get a wet towel and slap him across the face, trying to get me out of the DTs. And I'm crying or slapping him, and he'd say, "Go get me some chicken soup." And I'd go down the corner and make some money and then go get him some chicken soup and get him well enough to go to the doctor. It's not a big deal. That's just life. Well, I ended up marrying that girl. Everything was fine. She was just perfect, you know, everything. She'd never do anything to make me want to divorce her, and I was real smart, so I'd never do anything to make her want to divorce me, because I would never get caught. It's okay if you don't get caught, right? That was my thinking. So we married for a few years, had a baby. My life changed when I had a child. I needed to make more money and be more important, and you know, I had to take care of this baby. It was just a feeling inside. I went, you know, I moved to Florida. My father moved to Florida, and he got in the construction business. He said, "You come down here, we can do this construction, man. It's just booming." So I quit my job. I moved to Florida to start this construction business, and the construction business went boom. We struggled, I was self-centered. I cheated on my wife one time, and there was no way she was going to find out. Nobody she knew, she'd never run across, you know, just, it was, I had it all figured out, except I forgot one thing. I got an ego. And I'm sitting around the shop after work, and my buddies are bragging about their conquest, or, you know, this, that, and other. Well, I got to tell them about mine. And they weren't my buddies. They wouldn't tell my wife, because they maybe thought she told, they told her what I did, and maybe she'd do something with them. She asked if I ever did it. I said, "No, if I did, you'd never catch me." Ego, man. Made her mad. She's gonna. The only character defect I know about her was that she was vengeful. If we were walking down the street, she stumped her toe, she would hit me. Yeah. She had to strike out, and I heard her, and she had to strike out. But she couldn't just have sex with somebody. That just wasn't her way. You know, and I knew that. Yeah. Well, I didn't realize that she'd get to know somebody and get to be friends with them, you know, have an affair. Oh, Jesus. How could she do that to me? Oh, I couldn't stand it. Just, wait a minute, you know, just letting it go or something, you know. I first had the notion she was having an affair. I called a psychiatrist, got an appointment, went down and talked to the psychiatrist, says, I got to have some help, my wife, and I said, and I'll know, I'll end up catching them, and I'll kill somebody. That's what I was worried about. I was worried about catching them and kill somebody. She says, "How much money you got?" But that had to do with it. I told her, you know, how much money you make. I told her, she said, "Well, here, go to this address." The state agency, because, you know, I couldn't afford her. We went to the state agency, and she admitted to the psychologist there, she was just trying to hurt me as bad as she could. I said, "No, she's not like that. No, I'm not going to accept that." And I kept trying. She kept getting hurt. I'm taking it personal. And I called him and busted a bottle over a guy's head. He was running screaming for help, and I was trying to catch him. Because at that time, I was going to try to help him. When I was trying to catch him, he just slid out of my hand, and my fingers caught his eyelid, tore his eyelid off, half off. We took him to the hospital. Then I knew I had to leave. You know, as much as I didn't want my daughter to be in a divorced family, that wasn't going to work either, you know. The way I was acting, the way I felt, I didn't want her to be around me. So I got a divorce. At that point, I felt like a failure. So I had to have some relief. I had some way to get her out of my system. And I decided the only way I could get rid of her and forget about her is to learn to hate her. So I tried trying to hate her, and I got to find me a new woman. So where do you go to find a woman? You go to the bar. I went to the bar to find a woman like her. Sweet, and, you know, I just, it didn't, I don't know, something wrong with that equation. But one thing I could do, I could get drunk. If I got drunk enough, I could get picked up. See? But after I'm with a woman 3, 4, 5 times, I start to have feelings. I gotta get away. You know, she ain't the one I'm looking for, and I'm having feelings. For one thing, if she's not perfect, I'm gonna get hurt, and I can't face that. I'll become anorexic for a relationship. So I'm just going from one to the next. You know, just constantly looking, and then even got tired of that. You know. I'd been through a lot of jobs, for various reasons. But I find myself in the job down in, I live in St. Petersburg, down in Sarasota, and I've been going to the beach after work. They had this island right off from the main drag, and it's a 2-lane road, and there's nice, huge houses, and ever so often, 2 or 3 blocks, there'll be a little place to turn in and park 4 or 5 cars. You walk through the woods, you come out on this big, beautiful beach. I love to walk out there and watch the sunset, come back. One afternoon, I was coming back, hadn't seen anybody, nobody, you know, the whole time. I'm walking through the little piece of wood, I got to urinate, and I start to urinate, and all of a sudden, I hear 50 women giggling. I didn't hear them walking down the path. Oh, my God, I ran off the bushes, you know. Yeah, embarrassed a little bit. And they kept looking and craning their neck, you know, acting silly. Got out the car, and one of them gave me this Marilyn Monroe pose in their bikini, and I thought, wow, I got some attention from some women that aren't from the bar, you know, that aren't drunk, my God, and they're attractive, you know. Well, there may be something to this. Maybe this will attract women, I don't know. Well, left there, I went to 7-Eleven, unzipped my pants, and a lady walked out, got in the car next to me. She giggled and laughed and waved by and backed out. God, I can't believe this. The lady pulled in. Got out, saw me, stalked to the door and threw the door up and said, that son of a bitch. Oh, I got out of there. Oh, man, I can't believe it. Oh, I get in trouble. Oh, I'll never do this again. And I didn't until the next day. Well, what you got to do is make it look like an accident. See, that's what I did wrong. So you got to make it look like an accident, like you just happened to be sitting out in the middle of the parking lot playing with yourself, you know, and didn't see them coming, you know. Okay. But that's what I tried. And a couple of times it was okay, you know, got a thrill out of it, and woman looked just totally terrified. I said, oh, God, no. No, that's not me. Those are not the values I live by. I will not do that. I got out of there and went about my business, and a couple of days later, I'm trying to figure out how to do it without hurting somebody. You know, if I just handle it right, I can get away with it. It'd be okay. And I started a series of not being able to control that and controlling it. I would get up in the morning, I am not going to do that, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do that, and I'd go out and start driving down the street, and the force would overtake me. I got to try it, you know. Okay, if I just do it this way or that way. And I would spend, I had literally spent 24 hours straight trying to find a way to act out. I mean, through the night, go to all-night car washes, you know, waiting. Stalking, you know, somebody show up. How do I do that? I didn't eat nothing. I said, man, this is crazy. Now this went on and on and on. After a couple of years, I'm just getting, I'm devastated at this. Okay. You know, I've got to stop. You know, I made solemn vows, promises, prayed my butt off. I'm driving down the interstate, and I did it again. God, I said, this is it. I'm not going to do this. I can't do this. I'm just going to end it all. I'm cruising about 80 miles an hour down the interstate, and I floored it. I said, all right, there's an overpass up there. I'm going to hit that column, end it all. I floored it, and 90 miles an hour, I hit the grass. When I hit the grass, you know, it's like you're flying. You know, you're not even touching the ground, are you? And got some adrenaline going in me. And then the thought hit me, so, you idiot, you still got your seatbelt on. You might not die, you might just get hurt. I didn't want to hurt. I wanted to die. I wanted it over. The last thing I wanted was pain. You know, I don't like pain. No. So I turned the wheel. Took my foot out of gas, turned the wheel. The car turned sideways. And I'm going 90 miles an hour toward the column sideways. Well, this ain't gonna work. But it was, like I said, it was a big intersection, four lanes, and so it's a big concrete apron before you get there. So I hit the concrete, and I'm sliding. And right before you get to the column, the concrete's angled uphill a little bit for drainage. I hit that bank and shot across interstate, three lanes of traffic, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm heading toward concrete column on the other side. And I turn the wheel, and I'm sliding toward that one. Get right up to it and hit the bank, and back out in the middle of traffic. I catch myself in the middle lane. The car's going by the other side. I hit the gas. It's okay. I ain't touched nothing. Ain't nobody hit me. I said, thank God. I said, thank God. I'm such a good driver. Now, I didn't realize at the time, but that thought would haunt me for years. See, I couldn't give God credit for saving my butt. A situation of a miracle or just plain luck. It had to be my accomplishment. It had to be what I did. I drove my car through that. So I tried many things to stop and just couldn't. I finally decided, all right, I'm going to move back to Alabama after several weeks. During this time, right after I started the exhibition and acting out, I had to quit my job because I was just so mad and pissed off about everything that, you know, they pissed me off anyway. So, you know, the combination of, you know, being pissed off at them and being pissed off in general, I just quit. I decided I'm going to be a race promoter. I spent 9 years living in my car. The only time I have trouble acting out is when I'm in my car. And I'm living in my car. I got this figured out. Yeah. But I had finally got an apartment. I got a house trailer, with, and the kind that the wind blows through, you know. But it was shelter. It was a home, and I somewhere to hide out and not act out. I got a job throwing a newspaper out in the morning, at night, so I went out when people were out, and I was just hiding out. And when I did have to go out, I couldn't control myself. I couldn't control what I did. I had no choice in the matter, as much as I hated it. I was sitting at a trailer and walked and paced back and forth crying because I couldn't leave. Cussing God, cussing everybody I knew, everything that ever happened to me in my life was the cause of it. Just mad. And I had an idea. I said, well, I'm about to go crazy. I'm going to move back to Birmingham. I'm going to get with the family. My father's oldest brother, he's been the patriarch of the family. He knows, supposedly, the smartest one. So I'll tell him what's happening with me. And get in some kind of, you know, and then I'd have some accountability some way because I'm an honest person. So if I tell somebody I'm not going to do something, maybe I won't do it. And if he's going to ask me about it, I got to tell him the truth, and, you know, that maybe I could fix it. So I moved back to Birmingham. And I said, I got to get my uncle. But before I do, I want to act out one more time. I couldn't get from where I was at to telling him, but I'd act out one more time. And then my ego wouldn't let me tell him because I hadn't been clean long enough. I said, no, I'll quit for 3 weeks, and then I'll go tell him. So I get 3 weeks, think one more time. Yeah, and then I act out for a while, you know, until I get fed up with it again. This went on from 1994 to 1999. And finally, God did something for me. I had been praying to God the whole time. When I'm acting out, I'm praying, God, whatever it takes to get me out of this, whatever, anything, you know, be careful what you pray for. So God sent two angels that went to the police and reported me. A detective called me in. And this whole time I've been in Florida and in Birmingham struggling, I've been looking for this place I heard about called Sex Addicts Anonymous. I knew there was 12-step, I knew how to help my father, and I just got to find him. And I looked in every phone book, but I couldn't ask anybody. I couldn't call up a psychologist or anything and ask them how to get a hold of Sex Addicts Anonymous. They might ask me why. Well, no way, I was too ashamed. Hated what I was doing. I hated myself. There's no way I could tell anybody. But I got reported. The detective called me in, but these two women said, you did this, this, this on such and such a date. I said, I don't remember that time. that's a month ago. I forgot all about that one. He said, you sound like you need help. He told me about where SAA used to meet. He said, go to this address. It was ADAC building. And I went in there and I said, I'm looking for some help with addiction. Some lady said, fill out this piece of paper. I wrote down, what's your addiction? I said, sex, and turned the paper in. All of a sudden, there's three women standing in the hallway, looking at my paper, giggling. Yeah. So. And then finally one came in and I said, we got a hold of the director, and he's not here today. He'll be here tomorrow. Will you come in and see him tomorrow? And I did that. And he looked on his desk, and he fumbled, and he finally found a number for SAA, 933-0520, number we have today for SAA in Birmingham. I called the number, left a message. They called me right back. There's a meeting tomorrow night. I'll be there. I got there 30 minutes before the meeting. I'm running through this therapist's office. The meetings were downstairs at there. I'm running through the therapist's office. How much time I got left, Jim? Trying to find the meeting. You know, and I don't see it. Finally, somebody shows up. Well, the next meeting we have, the therapist down there says, y'all got to have somebody that shows up 30 minutes early for these people that are looking for a meeting, because we can't have them wandering through the building. People, you know, in therapy sessions, they hear people outside the door. They get kind of nervous. So I found SAA, and I found hope. I read the 12 steps, and this is what I was looking for. I could finally tell somebody. So I'd never admitted to the detective that I'd done anything. But finally in an SAA meeting, I could admit what I'd done. I could finally tell somebody. It was finally, I could finally share it with somebody, and that was important. God, it gave me hope, and I was the most hopeless person you could ever look at, you know. And some of the anger melted away, and I started, I'm going to get this program. I'm going to do this. I'm going to achieve this. 4.5 years later, I'm still trying to achieve this. All right, I've had 2 or 3 sponsors. Went through all the old timers, they left, you know. I can't believe I had the strength to run them off, but I don't know where they went, you know. Here comes another one, oh God. I was a little bit ahead of Jim, so when I asked him to sponsor me, I was on the 6th step and he was on the 5th. And we worked this thing together. Now I may tell you here in a minute, I'm gonna brush this up, but I'm gonna talk about my sponsor. And when I talk about my sponsor, it's all the sponsors I had to begin with, a lot to do with Jim, and all the talks from the convention. all the AA talks, so that's 200 of them. They were my sponsors. See, I started going to therapy 2 months after I come into SAA because I slipped. You know, I thought I'd had it made. You know, I'm here, I got hope. I never have to act out again. I felt it. I just happy, joyous, and free. I'd drive down the road without having to do anything. This is wonderful. And all of a sudden, one day, I took an opportunity and I took it. Oh, I can't believe I did that. I'm not going to, ooh, I feel so ashamed. I'm not going to tell anybody. If don't tell anybody, you don't have to be ashamed. But something had changed. I went to the meeting, I told them. Very next meeting. Something was changing. I wasn't fixed. It wasn't all done, but something was changing. I was getting honest, I guess. After that 4.5 years with my therapist, and I was still struggling, had a slip, what's wrong with me? Why can't I get this? He said, maybe you're just one of those who can't get it. What? Why don't you go to AA? Why don't you try that, you know? The first thing I did was complain about the meetings. Nobody there has long-term sobriety, you know. Me and Jim doing the best we can. You know, nobody there long-term. Why don't you go to AA, you know, see what they got. I can't go to AA. You got to be alcoholic to go to AA. He said, why don't you quit drinking? I said, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I can quit drinking anytime I want to. He said, how many times you quit? I said, I don't know, 10 or 12. He said, uh-huh. I knew what he meant. I went to AA and didn't have a real desire to not drink, but I wanted to hear what they had to say. And almost every meeting I saw somebody there that had something. Happy, joyous, and free. You know? I started going to meetings, AA meetings out there by my house, right in my neighborhood. People could see my car in the parking lot, you know? And I was going anyway. And I met my A sponsor, and he's the one that taught me to be grateful. I'm in a 12-step program. The old timer there, just every day is a holiday, and every meal is a banquet. I just want, you know, I want to moon him or something. Jeez, right. But they had something I wanted. What is it they got? How'd they get that out of the 12 steps? Well, that's what the 12 steps do for you if you work them. If you accept them as a way of living, not as just 12 things to do and think about. You have to do them. So, I really started, so that was, you know, that was another progression. A friend of mine was in 12-step group, invited me to go to this church he started going to, Disciples Fellowship. Not Disciples Fellowship, that's here. Disciples of Christ. They were a Native American church. Episcopal Native American church. But they sang songs on the big tom-tom drum. And it had a rhythm to it, and I kind of liked that. And then this preacher got up there, and he preached about this all-powerful, loving, forgiving God. I said, that's the one I've been looking for. That's the one I heard him talking about in AA. I said, if I could create my own God, that would be him. That's the one I'm looking for. So I got saved. Oh, and it felt good, you know. And I went to my meeting and said, guess what I accomplished? Guess what I did? And if less than a month later, I'm acting out again. So they talk about somebody getting baptized. That's why we all get baptized. I feel it. You know, I believe. I'm not playing around. I'm really going to do it. And I went and got baptized in Cahaba River. You know, almost drowned a preacher. Because I jumped backwards. He said, fall backwards. I jumped backwards. Boy, that felt good. And I went to my meeting, I said, guess what I did? Guess what I've accomplished? And a few months later, I'm acting out again. What in the hell is wrong with me? You know? I can't believe this. I'm distraught. Well, I started playing drums at church, and we was having this coronation of a pastor on a Saturday, and the cardinals are the higher-ups in the congregation are come up from Mobile, and they're fancy tall hats and fancy dress and everything, you know. And this lady's getting coordinated, asked for a special drum solo, and I'd play that for her. And I just, man, this was really spiritual, and I had been acting out for about a week. Really distraught, you know, but here I am in church and acting real good. And the next day we had a church service, and the preacher says, hey, anybody having trouble, you know, with such and such that they would like to talk about? Well, I jumped up and ran down there. I need something else, you know, something different. So now, in this church, this particular preacher, when somebody come up with problems, he'd pray for them, you know, put his hand on them and pray, and they'd fall down, you know. Pass out, just be still, or someone just cry, someone kick, you know, just different things, you know. It happened 4 or 5 times. And he's praying over me. And then he prays, and he says, God, remember, move, and he pushed on my head, and I'm going to knock me down. I pushed back, you know. He prayed some more, and pushed, and I'm pushing back. He ain't going to make me fall down. I ain't going to look like no fool in front of these people. You're messing with my ego, fella. You watch out, you know. And he prayed some more, and he pushed, and I pushed back. Well, I forgot something. See, I did a fifth step with this pastor. He knew everything about me. 3 prayed a little more, and he leaned in and said, you got to help. Whisper it to me. And I kind of had a, it kind of let me down. I thought God's supposed to knock me down, you know. I got to cooperate, you know, with God, for God to do something. You know, what kind of God is this? You know, where's his power at? Yeah. He prayed some more, and he said, remove the sexual perversion. I put the tail back. He started praying again. I said, I better fall down before I tell him the whole story. So he just prayed some more, and he pushed, and I just laid like a board. See, because it happened before, you know, the men in the congregation always stand behind whoever's getting prayed over to catch them, and they fall down. So I just made like a board, and I just falling straight backwards, and I'm falling and falling. I realized, they gave up and sat down. I heard the thump when I hit the floor. I didn't really feel it because I was already crying. I was bawling my eyes out. The past rushing through my brain. All the pain, the feelings, you know. The loss of my family getting divorced, you know, the sexual abuse and you know, and prostitution and just everything that's ever happened to me bad, you know. The hatred for the acting out I'd done, just the feelings just overwhelming. I'm just bawling my eyes. I mean, it must have been shooting out of my head, you know. Just crying and bawling, you know, after 15, 20 minutes. They said it was only, you know, 2, but it had to be 15 minutes. The pastor leaned over and said, you got to let it go. And I just, it kind of caught me by surprise. Let it go. Why don't you let it go? Let it go. And he said it again. He said, let it go. And I said, okay, I'll let it go. Now, they have the drum team. There's a fire marshal at the airport, and he had heard about it. I'd had heart bypass not too long before that, and he knew about it. He came with his hand on my chest, you know, trying to, he's worried about me, the way I was heaving in the hall, and, you know. And he reared back when I let it go. And I thought I saw a black cloud just kind of, blackish cloud, not a black one, but you know, just squiggly going up past him. He reared back. He told me after the service, he said, I felt something go by me when you quit crying and let go. And I thought I saw something. Now, you don't have to believe anything happened. It's not really important. See, I believed it. I had let it go. And I felt good, and I felt relief, and I ran to my meeting, and I said, guess what I did? guess what I've accomplished now? I've got this program now, you know, you can't tell me. And I guess, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, I was okay. An opportunity presented itself, situation, and I acted out again. I said, oh God, I can't believe this. See, I'd already quit drinking by this time. I quit drinking. When I went to AA, by the way, after about 6 weeks in AA, I caught alcoholism. I didn't know it was contagious, you know. So I decided I had to quit drinking. And I never knew how compulsive it was for me. It was just, I couldn't not drink because somebody told me I wasn't going to drink. When I decided I'm not going to drink, what in the heck is wrong with this? The more I try not to do something, the more I got to do it. What? How does that work? The more I fight it, the more power it has over me. It makes no sense. On July the 7th of 2003, I stopped at 7-Eleven, got a cup of coffee, went to pay for it. There's this cooler of ice down beer over here. And when you rang it up, there's a beer sitting there by that coffee. And I paid for them both, and I walked out in the parking lot, and I said, I can't believe I bought that beer, but since I bought it, I should drink it. So I popped the top, and I drank the beer, got in the truck, drove down the street, pulled out into a six-lane highway on Highway 31, going to turn left, got over in a turn lane, double turn lane, I got right behind this dump truck, said, you know, I'm a long way back in the line, so I'm going to keep after the dump truck. If this dump truck makes it through that light, I'm going to go right behind him so I can say, I didn't see the light, you know. I'll have my excuse for going through the light. And sure does, as soon as he went through, I'm right behind him, and the policeman almost ran into me, coming the other way, wanting to come ready to go. He fell in behind me, pulled me over, gave me a ticket. After he left, I pulled over in the parking lot, got a ticket, see how much it's going to cost me. He didn't write down, ran a traffic light. He wrote down, failure to yield. I said, that's a message. I am not giving up this stuff. I'm hanging on to it. That was the last drink I ever had. And I thought I was through acting out too, but because after that deal with the floor of the church, I was saying the fifth third step prayer every morning, praying at night. Every morning I, God, offer myself to you to be with me, do me this you will. Relieve me to bind yourself. First thing I'd every morning. And this one morning, October 23rd, I got up and I really did have to go to the bathroom, and the dog was dancing too. And I said, let's go, you know. We didn't pray, we went to the bathroom. I'm outside. On the way back in, I started to call. I said, gee, I'm coming down with something. A cold. I got to go to Walmart, and I got to get the big expectorant cough syrup. I know what I need, you know, it's going to make me feel better. I got to do something to make me feel better. And while I'm thinking about all of this, what I got to do, notion says, don't you think going to Walmart might be dangerous for you? Yeah, big parking lot like that? Oh yeah, that's right. Oh yes, yes. God, protect me when I go to Walmart. Not I surrender my will, my life, not I didn't do the third step, sir. I said, God, protect me. Here's your instructions for today, God. Not your will be done, but my will be done. So it was a Saturday. I had to go to work early. So I ran to work at 6 o'clock. And we were going to get off at noon. So all during the day, every time I'd cough, I'd say, I've got to go get the cough syrup. And, oh, no, maybe, okay, you shouldn't go there. Oh, no, God, you protect me when I go. Went to Walmart, pulled in, went in, got looking at the cough syrup, this nice lady, looking lady walked between me and the cough syrup, and wow, yeah. And I got my cough syrup, walked out the truck, and took the cough syrup, big juice bottle, chug, chug, chug. Wait a few seconds, nothing happened, I'm not feeling good. Chug, chug, chug. But in a few minutes, I drank that whole bottle of cough syrup. Then two women drove up, parked right next to me, and wearing Martian ears, you know, antenna, you know, and just giggling, having a good time. I said, oh, I'm going to, you know, but these sound like fun. I'm going to talk to these women after they get out. And well, they come out, and I'm talking to them, and I'm covered up, but not fully appropriately attired, but covered up. And one of them has a notion that I am. She walks back and forth down to her, back of her car, and back up the front, and, you know, checking out. And then she said, you should be ashamed of yourself. I'm sorry, you know. She got in the car and left. I said, well, I'm not going to get right behind her, you know. I don't want them to think I'm following them. I'm really not that kind of guy, you know. And here come the police. You're going to be arrested. These women are going to file a complaint, you know. So I called up and got somebody in the program, man. I know what's happening. I'm waiting to, you know, find out what's going to happen. The police said, well, they're going to go down, fill out the complaint, and then you'll be arrested, you know. But, you know, we're going to get to go now. So I called him back and said, okay, meet me at Waffle House. I hadn't ate yet, just, you know, 1:00, 1:30. Okay, so I went to the Waffle House. I'm sitting outside the Waffle House waiting on him. And I'm thinking about this. Oh, Jesus. Yeah. This is my second offense. First time I got off with a fine and reduced to a misdemeanor, to a disorderly conduct. Yeah, I got a real lucky the first time. This time it's going to be different, man. I'm going to be convicted. I'm going to probably have to go to jail for, you know, 30 days to a year. If I have to go to jail, I got to tell the job why I'm going, and they're going to fire somebody like me, you know. I'm going to lose my job. If I lose my job, I'm going to lose this truck I just bought and the house I'd bought 3 years earlier so I could move my mother in so she'd have somewhere to stay. And just everything I'm trying to do right and rebuild my life, I'm living on the street to, you know, to having something, I'm going to lose it all. It's just terrible. And the pity starts setting in. Oh, poor me, you know. And then I start, next thing I think is, well, if it wasn't for my past, those boys that gang raped me when I was 5 years old. You know, my parents getting divorced. That stranger on the train that scared me to death. I thought if I said something, he might try to shut me up and, you know, harm me or kill me. So I just laid there and pretended I was asleep. You know, the prostitution. Oh, I'm mad. You know, and then I said, wait a minute, you know, didn't you let that go? Didn't you forgive the past, the work you've done in this program? What's it saying in the big book about forgiveness? And you forgive, do not refute the work you've done. If it comes up, dismiss it at once. If you decide to forgive, you're forgiven. Don't take it back. I said, okay, I can't take it back. Okay, it's not the past. I've been through that with therapy and everything else, you know. We've handled that. I can't blame the past anymore. He said, it's just me. It's just me. I said, God, whatever happens in this situation, if I lose everything and go to jail, I pray that it be your will that happens. I don't care what happens to me. Whatever your will is, I accept. All I ask is that I learn from something from this to help somebody else. Some of those other men in those rooms, if I can tell them something to help them, you know, if I can be of some help to somebody else, that's all I ask for. And I said, I have done it now. And I took two deep breaths and I walked in the Waffle House, sat down. My friend, a few minutes, walked in later and said, how's it going? I said, it's okay. I said, it's going to be okay. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I'm hoping that God is going to miraculously, you know, change everybody's mind and make this go away. But in reality, I know what's going to happen. Yeah. God is going to give that judge, the complainants, the prosecuting attorney, my attorney, free will to do what they think is best. And I'm going to pay a price. It's, you know, There's going to be consequences. And it's going to be okay. Yeah. You'll survive. You come out the other end. Maybe you'll learn something. It's okay. I was okay with that. And that's when I realized God really did love me. Without changing the consequences, without anything else, He made me acceptance and have peace and serenity. I, at that time, understood peace, comprehended the word serenity, and I knew peace. That's why I always like to say that proves I'm a redneck. I had my spiritual awakening in a Waffle House. But I left that, and went home, just tickled to death, just so much at ease. I knew right then I'd never have to act that again. It was just annoying. Yeah. Unless I, myself, insisted upon it. I called my sponsor. I said, I did it, I surrendered. He said, thank God we got that over with. Now we can get started. I said, it took 4.5 years. He said, some are sicker than others. And my life's been different ever since. Some people say I help them. Sometimes I wonder if I do. You know, I had some sponsees that made it and some that didn't. I can't get you sober. I can only share my experience with you. Don't know whether they help you or not. It's just what happened to me. That's all we got, isn't it? Is our experience. Trust God. Clean house. Help others. Very simple principles. And that's all I got to do. Okay? To help others, I really need to learn to love. You know? Love's important, but it's not. It's great. But it's what I give. It's what's important about it. I didn't know how to have relationships. I told my sponsor, I don't know what I'm going to do about that boss now. Even though everything's wonderful, I'm still going to have, you know, trouble with that boss that's demanding and, you know, doesn't appreciate me. He said, look, you just need to work on your relationship. He said, try this prayer. When you go to work, say, God, take this relationship and make it what you would have it be. Allow me to see the truth. And said, on top of that, you will never, ever tell your boss what he's doing wrong ever again. I said, who's going to tell him? It made no sense. I thought, like I said, I thought I'd never have to act out again. And I think that's true. But I do have memories. I still think that sex is God-given, therefore good. I'm single, so somewhere I got to where I'm going to find this good sex, you know. And I used to sit in meetings and worry about it. And I think about it time. When does it go from being bad to being good, you know? What date? You know, is it third date, you know, second date? I mean, you know. What's a relationship got to be like? Do you have to be married? You know, I'm wondering, you know. And what's the program? Tell me. Trust God. Oh. You mean, I'm supposed to go on and just casually fall into relationships and God will tell me when it's okay to have sex? That's right. God, you know. Trust God to tell you. I don't control God. See? But I do know that he loves me. I do know that there is absolutely nothing I can do to make him love me more, and absolutely nothing I do to make him love me less. What? That's not like first step. I'm powerless over God. Kind of makes sense, doesn't it? I am powerless over God. And I thought I was making him happy and sad, and, you know, makes it, you know, every morning he checks his roster, see, you know, with what Tom did, so you know whether to be happy or sad. Yeah. No. I didn't have to check my roster, see what God did. Decide whether I'm going to be happy or sad. See? Because everything is exactly like it's supposed to be today. All I got to do is accept it and quit trying to make it all about me and what I want, what I didn't get out of it, how it affects me. When I can let go of the me, I can be free. When I don't have to have my way about anything, I can be happy about everything. Time. I thought it was about time. Thank y'all for letting me share. Keep coming back. It works if you work it.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom, for sharing that with us. A lot of good lessons there. I hope everybody was listening.